Support for this public radio podcast comes from Mellon Financial Corporation, helping financially successful individuals and families protect and maximize their assets through the practice of wealth management. Mellon.com. And by A.G. Edwards, caring for nest eggs for more than 120 years with a commitment to provide objective financial advice. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, dedicated to a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
It's not a bailout. Get that idea right out of your head. It's more like a rainy day fund, a really, really big rainy day fund. Three big banks, the Treasury Department, and a credit crunch that's clearly not over with. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by The Economist magazine, which tells not only what's happening around the world each week, but why. The Economist, at newsstands, in bookstores, and at economist.com. And by Vanguard, offering 529 plans for those thinking about saving for college at vanguard.com/529.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. Good to have you with us on this Monday. It's the 15th of October today. The banks in question are Citigroup, J.P. Morgan, and the Bank of America. They've been chatting amongst themselves for the past month or so about how to make sure the liquidity squeeze doesn't get any worse. And today they decided it's time to put up or shut up. Our New York Bureau Chief Jill Barshe is here to explain. Hi, Jill.
Hi, Kai.
Before we get to the whys, let's get to the nuts and bolts here. How's this thing going to work?
Well, they're calling it a master conduit. It's basically a special fund, and they're going to put up tens of billions of their own dollars, maybe as much as $100 billion. And they're going to take that money, and they're going to use it to buy mortgage securities that nobody else wants right now. Many of the big Wall Street banks, including some of the ones establishing this fund, are holding these mortgage securities, and they don't want to have to dump them at fire sale prices and take even more losses on their books. And these banks, they compete against each other, so it's very unusual for them to cooperate like this and may be a violation of antitrust rules. So the Treasury Department got into this and helped them coordinate it. They've been talking quietly for a month now. They even got together on a Sunday trying to figure out how to put it together, but there's no tax dollars in it. It's all the Wall Street banks' own private money.
All right, but Jill, help me understand something. I thought, and we have certainly been saying on the program, that the credit squeeze has been easing, that some of these deals are getting done now because people are more comfortable lending money. If that's the case, why do we need this fund?
You're right, Kai. Most of the credit markets have gotten back on their feet, but there are still parts of them that have not returned to health. And there's a fear that these stuck parts could trigger yet another market tumble. So this master conduit, this fund, it starts buying mortgage securities. It can establish a price floor for bonds that are still in trouble so that the floor doesn't drop out again and then the other markets follow with it. I talked with Peter Wallison at the American Enterprise Institute, and this is what he told me.
It's not exactly a bailout. It's more like the banks taking a risk to get a market started that would be good for them and for everyone else, including buyers of homes.
And not just home buyers, but also ordinary investors, because if a tumble in the mortgage bond market starts triggering a tumble in the equity markets, we could all be losing money in our portfolios.
Jill, let me back you up to something Peter Wallison said about the market getting restarted. What happens if those markets don't restart, or if it comes to worse, the market starts and it doesn't go well and this fund has to step in?
So what's going on right here is that the banks owe a lot of money that's coming due, short-term debt, and this debt comes due in November. And if the investors ask for their money back, the banks don't have that money immediately. They're going to have to come up with cash. And what they need to sell are their mortgage securities. And the fear is that there'll be this huge fire sale. They'll just have to get rid of mortgage securities. Nobody wants it. That's where the rescue fund comes in. It will buy up these mortgage securities. Now, if there is no rescue fund here, the price will just go spiraling downwards, and it will depress debt prices across the board. And it could eventually affect the rest of the credit markets and make people reluctant to lend money to one another. And that eventually can touch the whole economy.
Jill Barshe at the Marketplace Bureau in New York City. Thank you, Jill.
It's been a pleasure.
It was just happenstance, we know, but the Nobel Memorial Prize in Economics that was announced this morning fits right in with what Jill and I were just talking about, fixing a market that doesn't work. From Washington Marketplace's John Dimsdale has that story.
The prize winners are Americans Leonid Hurwitz, Eric Maskin, and Roger Meyerson for their work on mechanism design theory. The theory is a set of calculations to help create the ideal, most efficient financial markets for buyers and sellers. How do you make sure sellers get the highest price for their product or service while the buyer gets the cheapest possible price? It's a complex theory because people sometimes make financial decisions with imperfect information, or they allow emotion to color their choices. And that's what's happened in the subprime mortgage market, says University of Texas economist James Galbraith.
What we have in the subprime crisis is the innovation of particular types of mortgages that are meant to basically trap people into loans which look good for the first few years, but then when interest rates rise and suddenly they become unpayable. That's a question of the rules not having been developed and not having been enforced that would protect vulnerable low-income people from what were essentially fraudulent practices.
Galbraith and other economists like Stanford University's Kenneth Arrow say the mathematical formulas in the financial design theory have become part of the DNA of economics.
The value of these formulas is it forces people to ask the right empirical questions, how to study the past data to make the best use of it.
Arrow says the prize-winning design theory can help bankers, lenders, and government regulators set up more efficient and stable mortgage markets. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
Investors didn't care at all for that news. The Treasury Department's still worried about the credit squeeze. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Early returns are dribbling in the presidential race. Not votes, but perhaps the next best thing. Midnight tonight's the deadline for candidates to report their third quarter finances. The race for the White House gets most of the political money headlines, but it's often others who use the power of the purse most effectively. Over the past 20 years, Alaskan oil entrepreneur Bill Allen and people who work for him have given more than $1 million to candidates running for Congress. Allen pleaded guilty earlier this year to illegally bundling those federal campaign contributions and to bribing state politicians. But his connections also gave him another way to influence Washington: fishing. Marketplace's Steve Henn has more.
For years, Bill Allen was a supporter of two Alaskan charities with ties to the state's senior senator Ted Stevens and his former Republican colleague Frank Murkowski. The charities have spent millions on lavish fishing tournaments, bringing Washington bigwigs to Alaska to catch salmon and mingle with executives and lobbyists. If lawmakers paid for these trips, they would cost about $1,000 a night, but they don't. Instead, political committees and a network of nonprofits backed by lobbyists pick up the tab. There's no evidence these trips broke the law, but Ken Boehm, chairman of the National Legal Policy Center, say the charities deserve much more scrutiny.
You do have to look a lot closer at everything their money touched.
The law, even after recent ethics reforms, allows charities and Senator Stevens' campaign staff to keep secret the names of politicians they fly to Alaska. But Marketplace obtained guest lists of the events and hundreds of photos, including dozens of Bill Allen, with some of the most powerful legislators in Washington. Melanie Sloan runs the Center for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington.
If you're in Washington, it's hard to get more than a few minutes at a time of a senior member of Congress. Whereas if you are suddenly seated next to them on a fishing boat in Alaska, you will have hours and hours of uninterrupted time. And during that time, you may not mention the legislative issue you need help with, but you'll be building a relationship.
Sloan says the access these fishing trips offer oil executives like Allen is priceless. But
members of Congress are only spending this much time with a person like Bill Allen for the money.
Allen gave a lot of money to Stevens, the powerful chairman of the Senate Appropriations Committee. Stevens also used Allen's money to help elect fellow Republicans and then drew them into a circle that included loyal allies like Allen. The experience of Norm Coleman shows this process in action and the risks of these relationships. In the summer of 2002, Stevens and Allen worked together to pump more than $100,000 into hard-fought Senate races. Coleman in Minnesota got close to $25,000 from Stevens and his allies, including a bundle of contributions from Allen's employees. Coleman won, and a few months later, Stevens invited him to Alaska for a fishing trip. Coleman took his son and returned for 3 straight years. Cultivating a close relationship with Stevens, who controlled billions in federal spending, was an important part of Coleman's new job. But accepting these free trips carried a risk, says Meredith McGeehee at the Campaign Legal Center.
There's always a question raised when public officials in high public office are traveling on someone else's dime.
In the mid-90s, the Senate took steps to ban trips like these, but Senator Stevens and a circle of supporters, including Allen, worked together to find a way around that rule. Federal election law allowed political committees to pay for Coleman's flights to Alaska. Senate ethics rules let him accept free flights from Anchorage to the fishing tournament and stay free at a private riverside home. Federal law, however, does require political committees that pay for such trips to register with the Federal Elections Commission. The committee Stevens' allies set up to pay for Coleman's first trip to Alaska didn't. And that may be a violation of campaign finance laws, according to a former FEC general counsel and other experts. Meredith McGeehee.
When you are in such a mad dash to find the money and to find ways to gain that little advantage, it's going to attract a lot of these folks who play very, very close to the line and sometimes step over.
So what did Stevens and his supporters like Allen get for their trouble? In the case of Norm Coleman, maybe nothing, but it was very clear what Stevens wanted. From 2002 through 2005, Stevens and Bill Allen were in a major push to open the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge to oil drilling. Coleman had promised in his Senate campaign to oppose that plan. In 2005, there was a series of votes in the Senate over drilling in the Arctic. Opponents of drilling say it became harder and harder to pin Coleman down before each vote. In Minnesota, Scott Elkins at the Sierra Club says he eventually came to believe Coleman was a swing vote.
We had to fight tooth and nail to keep Senator Coleman to his word.
In December 2005, the debate over Arctic drilling came to what appeared to be the decisive vote.
And Senator Coleman, when his vote most mattered, turned his back on that promise and decided to vote in favor of opening the Arctic to oil drilling.
Was Coleman influenced by his relationship with Stevens and his Alaskan friends? Coleman says no. The very next day, he voted to strip the Arctic drilling provision out of the bill, which also funded troops in Iraq. And in 2006, Coleman disclosed his free fishing trips on his website, even though Senate rules don't require making these trips public. But this year, Bill Allen pleaded guilty to corruption charges. Senator Stevens is under federal investigation. Coleman hasn't been back to Alaska. But while raising money for what's expected to be a hotly contested re-election race, he offered donors some trips with himself, including one to California for a Napa Valley wine tour. In Washington, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
We've got more about Senator Coleman's first trip to Alaska and pictures of Bill Allen mixing with Washington power brokers on our website. It's marketplace.org. Click on the link that says Power Trips. And now, let's do the numbers. Some fretting by investors over bad debt and rising oil prices trimmed stocks today. The Dow Industrial has lost 108 points. That's more than 0.75% to close at 13,984. The NASDAQ lost 0.9%, 25 points. Ended the day at 2780. The S&P 500 dropped 0.8%, 13 points, 1548, the number there. Citigroup fell 3.4% today after the company said it'll delay repurchase of some of its shares. Toymaker Mattel sank 1%, that after it posted some lackluster earnings. Biogen IDEC popped up 18% on news the biotech firm could be a buyout candidate. And electronics maker Tektronix buzzed up 33% today. That on news of a $2.8 billion buyout by Danaher Corporation. Bond prices fell. When that happens, the yield rises. The yield on the 10-year T-note, in this case, rose to 4.68%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. By Siemens, from generators that power cities to light bulbs for homes, from factory automation to medical diagnostics, Siemens 70,000 U.S. employees providing solutions for America. And by U.S. Trust, Bank of America Private Wealth Management, committed to understanding the values that truly matter to clients and offering a personal approach to managing their wealth. hear a song on Marketplace, but you just can't place it? Or maybe it's the first time you've heard it and you want to hear it again. Just click on the archive section of our website. We list the songs we play on every show in that day's rundown. There's even a link to an online store where you can buy the song and help fund public radio programming. It's all at marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a glance at what's coming up Tuesday. In Washington, the Federal Reserve reports on industrial production for September. A House committee meets to receive testimony on medical care for federal civilian employees deployed to combat zones. And it's World Food Day, calling attention to the struggle against hunger, malnutrition, and poverty. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl. You've all heard of social networking, right? Sites like MySpace and Facebook. Various groups have created their own special places online. Physicians call theirs Sermo. Thousands of doctors have registered as members. They discuss cases with each other there. They ask questions, trade diagnoses. They blog about different medicines and techniques. Today, they decided to let the drug maker Pfizer in on the conversation, which has in turn caused a little bit of indigestion. Stacey Vanek-Smith reports.
Sermo was launched about a year ago and now has more than 30,000 members. Doctors join for free. Sermo makes its money by letting hedge funds, government agencies, and drug companies pay to peek at what all those doctors are talking about. Founder Daniel Palestrant says he was worried about corporate partnerships until members started asking for it.
What the doctors were saying was that Sermo has quickly become sort of a voice among physicians. And industry needs to participate and needs to hear that voice.
Today, Sermo announced it will partner up with Pfizer. In exchange for an undisclosed chunk of change, Pfizer will be allowed to have company-affiliated doctors contribute to Sermo blogs, weigh in on discussions, and offer information about Pfizer products. Merrill Guzner is with the Center for Science in the Public Interest.
You might call it a coup for Pfizer to break open this brand new way of marketing to physicians.
Guzner says drug companies are facing an uncertain future. Many best-selling drugs like Lipitor are rolling off patent, not to mention states are cracking down on drug companies' gifts and freebies for doctors. Still, Guzner says letting big drug companies infiltrate Sermo could be bad for patients.
We need, as patients and consumers, to see physicians talking among themselves about what's best for patients, not having another space where every time they turn around, it's the equivalent of a drug rep with a pizza showing up to tell them, hey, here's the possible solution.
But there could be real advantages to Pfizer's presence on Sermo, says James Unland, president of Health Capital Group consulting firm.
Drug companies can put audio and video interviews with experts in particular drugs. And there is a way to do this creatively and actually inform the doctors in greater depth than they ever could in a magazine or on television.
And Pfizer's not the only one. Unland says with revenue shrinking and growing regulations over how they can market to doctors, drug companies will have to start getting creative. I'm Stacey Vanek-Smith for Marketplace.
A jury in Nevada leveled a $99 million damage award against Wyeth Pharmaceuticals today. It's specifically for punitive damages in a case about hormone replacement therapy. On Friday, that same jury had its compensatory judgment cut from $134 million down to $34 million. The number of the day today is $13.87. That's how far away oil is from $100 a barrel this afternoon. Crude spiked about 3% on worries of a supply squeeze this winter. Geopolitical unease in the Middle East didn't help any either. We'll save you having to do the math. $86.13 was the close today in New York. Those rising oil prices played into the stock market today, as I mentioned. They're also boosting the fortunes of China's biggest oil and gas company. Thanks to the crude-induced run-up in its share prices, for today at least, PetroChina is the second biggest publicly traded company in the world, that by market capitalization. It's ahead of General Electric, just behind ExxonMobil. In Beijing today, the Communist Party Congress began. Delegates retreated to a 2.5-hour opening speech from President Hu Jintao, in which he talked lots of politics, not so much economics. Marketplace's Scott Tong is with us from Shanghai to right that wrong. Hey, Scott.
Kai, how are you?
I'm all right. So, listen, the Party Congress is nominally a political event, but as with so many things in China these days, there's economic stuff behind it. What is the economic story here?
Well, they're quite happy with 11% growth in China. The problem is that growth has created a number of side effects. And President Hu Jintao wants to implement what he calls the harmonious society to get at some of those side effects. Pollution, a big problem in China, and distribution of wealth is something that he's really concerned about as well. The issue really is to not just have economic growth at all costs, but to improve the quality of economic growth, as some people put it.
Well, how's he going to go about that?
What he's doing is passing a whole lot of laws and policies, but the problem is they're hard to implement at the local level. And the local guys, their incentive is to have economic growth at all costs, because that's what they're promoted on. Think about the process that we all love here at Marketplace, the annual performance review, right? Well, imagine if about 70% of your promotion were just based on how many whatevers you created, right? Show me the money. What are your numbers? Well, that's how it tends to work in China. So these local officials, in some cases, they employ slave labor, or they allow factories to create bootleg DVDs, or factories that cut corners, like use lead paint instead of the more safe stuff.
What you're talking about, the word you're not using, though, is corruption.
Well, that's right. When you talk to people at on the ground in China, in the villages, etc., what they say is, you know, for the small enterprises all around China to stay in business, they give the local officials a little cut, and the local officials kind of look the other way to allow it to happen. And in some cases, you have to pay off the local official because they control access to land, access to capital in China. Now, having said that, if China sounds like the most corrupt country in the world, that's probably not true. The nonprofit Transparency International just recently came out with a ranking of corruption around the world, and out of 179 countries, China was tied for 72 with India.
Bring this full circle for me to the thing we started with, that 11% year-on-year growth. How is any of what the central government does going to influence that growth if really it's local officials who are doing all the shenanigans and pumping out all the widgets and all the pollution?
Well, what the central government is trying to do is it's going to sound boring, but they're hiring more bureaucrats to try to implement a lot of these policies, a lot of the laws that they've passed. But the truth is, as you say, China is very decentralized, and it goes all the way back to Deng Xiaoping and more than 20 years ago when he decided that the way for China to grow was to allow these local officials, provincial officials, to have the freedom to go out and try things and to experiment. And you have to say it's worked. I mean, this economic miracle of China is largely because the government has decentralized and allowed the provinces and the cities to go out and find the best ways to grow the economy in China.
To get rich is glorious, right?
Well, everyone here is working on it. You can certainly hear that in Shanghai.
Scott Tong in Shanghai for us. Thank you, Scott.
All right, Kai. Thanks.
The National Retail Federation estimates we'll spend more than $5 billion this year on candy, costumes, decorations, and other assorted paraphernalia for Halloween. Among those celebrating the holiday, 11% will outfit their pets with a costume. So says the Retail Federation's Halloween Consumer Intentions and Actions Survey. Kids still like the classics. Princess, Spider-Man, Pirate, and Witch are the top four ranking costumes this year. Disney's Hannah Montana is making a late push. But on this edition of The Lowdown, commentator Sandra Tsinglo says she finds the whole Halloween experience ghoulish.
As a mother of two elementary school-aged children, I'm bracing myself for another Halloween. The season annually kicks off with an elaborate memo from our school regarding do's and don'ts for the Halloween costume parade. No fake blood, no fake guts, no fake weapons, masks only to be worn during the parade. My second grader wants to march as Princess Jasmine, which is fine as Disney characters have not been banned from our school yet, and happy that her needs are so legal, we trot off to the Halloween store at the mall and big mistake. Have you been to a Halloween store recently? Why do movies have R ratings but not stores? Even at our local pharmacy, hanging from the ceiling are life-sized skeletons, melting scream masks, rotting corpses, severed heads, heads with bleeding hatchets driven into the forehead, eyeballs popped out amidst nests of blood-clot matted hair. I think I slipped on some brains in the shampoo aisle. What's in the next aisle? A live cockfight? And I'm sorry, but Halloween store purveyors are shifty. It's not just their brutally hand-lettered, slightly misspelled signs on the register. No returns, no exchanges, no refunds. No, 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 no. Halloween store managers are always these callow 25-year-old wheeler dealers yelling into cell phones as they rearrange the hot pink nylon wigs on mannequins showing costumes for the women, which are always porno witch, vampire stripper. There's actually D-cup cleavage you can strap over your chest for females not busty enough to make it through Halloween. $30 later, I had scored child-sized harem pants and a plastic tiara. $5 for materials, $25 for the corporate licensing, which makes me think next year for my kids, a simple white sheet. It's free, hence for Halloween merchants. Truly spooky.
Sandra Tsinglo lives right here in Los Angeles. Send us your thoughts. Our website is marketplace.org. Click on the link that says contact.
Marketplace is supported by Consumer Consequences, American Public Media's online game exploring what the world would be like if everyone on Earth consumed like you. Online at consumerconsequences.org. And by Putnam Investments, where a well-thought-out allocation strategy can strengthen your portfolio. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
This final note today. Soap opera lovers will recognize that tune as the opening bars of As the World Turns. Not that I've ever watched, mind you. For years, Procter & Gamble has been a major sponsor of the soaps, as you know. It started as a campaign to attract housewives doing the dishes while watching the tube. But now, apparently, there's a younger crowd to win over when it comes to dirty laundry. That's the theme from a new P&G soap opera, Crescent Heights, it's called. It features Ashley, Will, Eddie, and Liz, young, hip professionals living in the same apartment building with lots of clothes to wash, I guess.
What do you think?
You look hot.
Oh, great, because I love this dress. It's my favorite. Wish me luck.
P&G's Tide detergent gets frequent cameo appearances, but don't look to television if you have some free time to kill. Catch up online or via your cell phone only. And that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow tripped down 108 points, 0.75% on worries about credit and debt and rising oil and all that stuff. The NASDAQ gave up 25 points. That is 0.9%. The S&P 500 dipped 13 points, 0.8% on that particular index. Our producers include Caitlin Carroll, Jennifer Collins, Megan Larson, and Fiona Ng. Marketplace was created by Jim Russell. Coming up next time, Gucci, Prada, Dolce & Gabbana. It's the ABCs of shopping with teens.
Show me any pair of jeans and I can tell you, just seeing a stripe or something embroidered or a piece of thread, I know what type of jean it is. It's pathetic, but it's true.
Oh, my God. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Please join us again tomorrow.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.